This week on America Interrupted from the PBS NewsHour, many people who get COVID-19 recover quickly, but for a growing number who don't, their symptoms are wide-ranging and long-lasting.
It felt like a monster had started to inhabit my body.
The act of folding towels left me breathless.
I recorded a heart rate of 210 at one point, sitting down in a chair.
I suffered debilitating tremors. I'm learning how to walk again.
We talk with COVID long haulers, people who can't shake the debilitating effects of the virus on their bodies, and ask a vascular biologist how doctors are trying to unravel this medical mystery.
We have vaccines, we have better antiviral treatments. We have nothing for long haulers yet.
Listen and subscribe to America Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
Good evening, I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Feeling the pain, the economy faces an uneven recovery as daily coronavirus deaths top 5,000 for the first time. And Congress begins to move closer to passing a relief package. Then, 6 months later, a worsening pandemic complicates Beirut's long recovery from the massive explosion that devastated the city.
The explosion was yet another blow in a year that had already seen the currency lose 80% of its value. And now, just as the city was getting back on its feet, it's been floored by a devastating wave of COVID-19.
And it's Friday. David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart consider the Republican Party's identity crisis and the ongoing pandemic relief negotiations. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. President Biden's plans to pass a nearly $2 trillion economic stimulus package picked up some momentum today as Democrats in Congress approved a basic blueprint. While the measures don't have the force of law, lawmakers are expected to begin writing details of a major package next week. As White House correspondent Yamiche Alcindor reports, the president made his case on the same day as the release of another weak jobs report tied to the pandemic.
Today at the White House, President Biden doubling down on the need to pass his COVID relief plan.
I see enormous pain in this country. A lot of folks out of work, a lot of folks going hungry, staring at the ceiling tonight wondering, what am I going to do tomorrow? So I'm going to act, and I'm going to act fast.
The president dismissed Republican concerns that the $1.9 trillion package is too much.
What Republicans have proposed is either to do nothing or not enough. All of a sudden, many of them have rediscovered fiscal restraint and the concern for the deficits. But don't kid yourself. This approach will come with a cost. More pain for more people for longer than it has to be.
Biden is calling on lawmakers to pass the plan fast. Among other things, it calls for $1,400 direct payments to individuals, which Biden says are non-negotiable. Increase weekly federal unemployment benefits to $400 and extending federal jobless programs through September. Earlier in the day, President Biden met with congressional Democrats. After the meeting, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said a bill would absolutely be passed by March 15th. That's when enhanced federal unemployment benefits are set to expire. Overnight, the Senate approved a budget resolution that would allow it to fast-track the aid without Republican support. And today, the House followed suit. The hours-long session included votes on amendments that could define what goes into the actual bill.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Among the votes, a rejection of hiking the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour. Republicans and some economists argue that since the worst of the pandemic, the economy has rebounded. Some sectors, including professional and business services, have recovered well. And this week, the Congressional Budget Office projected that GDP would rise to pre-pandemic levels before the end of this year. But this morning, the nation woke to a bleak picture of the economy, still hurt by the pandemic's winter surge. The Labor Department's January jobs report revealed U.S. employers added only 49,000 jobs. The unemployment rate fell, but remained high at 6.3%. And of the 22 million jobs lost since last spring, about 10 million jobs remain lost. That's worse than at the height of the financial crisis. Angela Retamoza is one of the 4 million Americans who have been out of work for more than 6 months.
I kind of feel like I'm in limbo. So yeah, it can be somewhat discouraging at times, but I just keep trudging along.
Since March, she has relied on state unemployment aid. And she said the extra federal unemployment benefits have helped her make ends meet.
It alleviates so much stress. It's not like my stress completely went away, but to know that I can pay my rent and my bills and put food on the table, because just unemployment on its own really only pays my rent and my utilities. And then everything else, I've got to figure out how I'm going to do that. So the extra is really helpful.
At the heart of a bifurcated recovery, job losses for women. Women account for most of the nearly 10 million jobs still lost, with women of color hit especially hard. Overall, the jobless rate for Black Americans and Hispanic Americans are both still higher than the national average. And since the start of the pandemic, the Federal Reserve reports that wealth for the top 1% of earners went up 400% compared to the bottom 50%. In March, Lyda Parker Sylvester was furloughed from her job in the hospitality industry. She said looking for work has been grueling.
The job search has been really difficult. I just put in job after job. It has to be over 100 jobs that I have applied for. The most work I've been able to find is part-time work here and there.
In January, the service sector shed 127,000 jobs. The industry continues to represent the overwhelming majority of jobs lost long-term or permanently.
We have experienced a 72% loss in revenue compared to last year.
Amy Scheid runs a restaurant and catering business in Wisconsin Rapids, Wisconsin. She has not been able to bring back most of her staff, and she says help from Washington isn't coming fast enough.
When payroll rolls around, it's coming from my personal savings. There is no money in the business for anything other than the food necessary to keep moving forward, the mortgage that cannot be ignored, and the utilities that cannot be ignored. We've watched business after business after business close already.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Yamiche Sandor.
Let's take a closer look now at who's bearing the brunt of the pandemic's economic pain and whether federal relief efforts are reaching those who are most in need. For that, we turn to Rafael Bostic. He's the president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta. Mr. Bostic, thank you so much for joining us. Let me start by asking you about the economy overall. It was just a few days ago the Congressional Budget Office was forecasting we're going to see a robust recovery in the middle of this year. But then today and yesterday, we're seeing discouraging reports about unemployment, how many people are out of work and have been for a long time. What does this economy look like to you?
Well, I think there are two things to keep in mind here. One is that In the current period, we have a virus that is still going through the economy and going through our population quite significantly. So while that's happening, we're going to see choppy times, and I think we're going to have rough times for the next couple of months. But as the vaccine gets further into the population, I do think we're going to turn to a much more robust growth period, but that's going to not come until the summertime at the earliest. So we've really got to try to weather this time as much as we can.
Well, to bring it down to the individual level, who in this economy is doing well or maybe about to do better, and who is going to be struggling for the foreseeable future?
Well, this pandemic has really hit the population in two different ways. We have a number of people who have jobs where they're able to work from home. They don't necessarily need to be next to people or close to people to do their work. They're doing fine, and they're going to continue to do fine. It's people who have jobs where proximity is important, the service industries like in restaurants and then grocery stores, those are the types of jobs we're going to see struggles, and that will likely continue for months to come.
So given that, Mr. Bostic, what do you make of the Biden administration's proposal for COVID economic relief? $1.9 trillion, and we know that could change some, but that's what they're proposing. What do you make of the focus of it, the price tag, and what it's aiming to fix?
Well, I think it's very important that we get relief to people across the economy because there's still a lot of uncertainty that's out there, and people are nervous, and people need to have that support and know that that's there. I think the support to unemployment insurance is extremely important because those are people we know have problems, but we also have to think about how we get support to small businesses that may not have participated in the Paycheck Protection Program, and to a number of families that have really stepped away from employment altogether. We can't forget them because they are definitely at risk.
Well, as you know, different groups of economists have looked at what Americans have done with last year's federal government payouts. And the reports that I've seen, they found that $1.6 trillion of it has still not been spent. It's being saved or it's being used to pay off debt. In fact, I was reading this morning that households earning over $78,000 a year have spent less than 10% of what they received in federal payouts. Does that tell you that we need to see more targeting in what the government does next?
Well, I definitely think targeting is important, but I also think it's important to remember that we still have a lot of uncertainty, and it's not exactly clear where pain is going to hit in the population for the next several months. And so you saw from the Federal Reserve, we acted big and we acted bold in the beginning because we didn't want the edges to be lost. And so I think the approach that we've taken thus far has really been to say, we'd rather err on the side of being too supportive than not supportive enough, because if we fall short in that support, the damage to the economy and the people who are hurt more permanently is going to be more significant.
And are you saying that applies to this upcoming COVID relief package as well? It's the danger is in not doing enough rather than doing too much?
Well, I think we've learned in the last several episodes of crisis that doing more is better. But we are also learning things through the experience as we move forward, and that should guide targeting. And I'm having conversations with policymakers to try to assist in that, and I'm hopeful that the targeting will be more effective as we move through the next several months.
You mean toward the lower end of the income scale?
Toward those who have lost their jobs, who are still out of work, and to small businesses in many communities across the country that are the lifeblood for many small towns and many neighborhoods. We've got to make sure that they stay afloat so that when we get to the other side, the communities have a foundation from which they can grow and prosper.
Mr. Bostic, you said last October that this pandemic economy has, and I'm quoting you, you said it's laying bare and exacerbating disparities that have long plagued our economy along ethnic, racial, gender, geographic, and occupational lines. You said the Fed must participate in a deeper and more creative reckoning with a history of racial injustice that continues to weaken the economy for all of us. My question to you is the Fed doing that? Have you been doing that? And if so, how?
We are absolutely doing that. We have spent a lot of effort raising the issues that are important in terms of understanding those racial barriers and the structural things that are keeping people from being fully engaged. We are bringing people together with solutions and talking about how we can apply them in communities and in our policy. And we are having conversations with businesses across the country to really get them to examine their practices and policies and to rethink how they engage with people across the country, and in particular in neighborhoods where they have not necessarily been so attentive. And so we are really trying to drive a different kind of conversation and have that conversation translate into action, because action is really what we need to see.
And do you think you're making progress?
I know we're making progress, and I see that every day in my district here in Atlanta and across the country.
Rafael Bostic, who is the president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Judy. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
In the day's other news, the Pentagon announced that it will deploy more than 1,100 active duty troops to assist at 5 COVID-19 vaccination sites. Each team will consist of 222 personnel, including 80 who can administer vaccines. Senior White House COVID-19 advisor Andy Slavitt said the military's support will help expedite inoculations.
Part of this group will start to arrive in California within the next 10 days to begin operations there around February 15th, with additional vaccination missions soon to follow. The military's critical role in supporting sites will help vaccinate thousands of people per day and ensure that every American who wants a vaccine will receive one.
The Biden administration is also investing in six companies to boost production of at-home COVID testing kits. They hope to make more than 60 million tests available by the end of the summer. That comes as the U.S. set another grim record overnight. Daily COVID deaths topped 5,000 for the first time ever. The U.S. trade deficit surged to a 12-year high in 2020 due to pandemic disruptions. The Commerce Department reported the gap between exports and imports rose 18% last year to $679 billion. That was due in part to COVID restrictions that upended key exports of U.S. services like tourism and education. In Myanmar, hundreds of students and teachers protested today against the military coup in the largest rallies to date since the takeover. They rallied at two universities in Yangon. The protesters held up a three-finger salute as a sign of resistance and carried signs with images of ribbons to symbolize civil disobedience. One teacher voiced hope the military coup would fail.
We don't want this military coup, which unlawfully seized power from our elected government. We don't want anyone who steals power and then forms their own government. We are no longer going to work with them.
At least 30 people have been arrested for protesting against the coup. The military says that they will hold on to power until a new election is held in a year. Delegates from Libya's warring factions approved an interim government today to help unify the divided country. It has had two separate governments, one in the east and one in the west. At a United Nations forum in Geneva, they selected four leaders to lead Libya through the national elections in December. The North African country has been in turmoil since Muammar Gaddafi's four-decade rule ended in 2011. Back in this country, stocks on Wall Street notched their fifth consecutive day of gains. The Dow Jones Industrial Average climbed 92 points to close at 31,148. The NASDAQ rose 78 points, and the S&P 500 added 15. And a passing to note tonight, award-winning actor Christopher Plummer died today at his home in Connecticut. During his nearly 70-year career, Plummer became known for a wide variety of roles that won him an Oscar, two Emmys, and a pair of Tony Awards. Jeffrey Brown looks back on some of Plummer's most iconic roles.
He was a leading Shakespearean actor throughout his life. But it was this role,
as I sound your signals, you will step forward and give your names,
as Captain Von Trapp opposite Julie Andrews in the beloved 1965 film Sound of Music, that catapulted Canadian-born Christopher Plummer to stardom. He famously disparaged the part at first, but later came to terms with it and the success it brought. Plummer went on to star in a wide range of films, from Tolstoy in The Last Station to playing the voice of the villain in the cartoon film Up. And he had an extraordinary film renaissance late in life.
I'm gay.
His role in Beginners as a man who comes out as gay after 44 years of marriage made him the oldest actor to win an Oscar at 82.
You know, my mother once predicted that that I would have to wait to be a very old man before receiving recognition in our profession. She was absolutely right, of course.
He continued acting in recent years, starring in the crime thriller All the Money in the World and in the 2019 film Knives Out. Christopher Plummer died at his Connecticut home this morning after a blow to his head from a fall. He was 91 years old. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown.
And still to come on the NewsHour, COVID-19 complicates Beirut's recovery from a devastating explosion. David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart break down a packed week of politics. We remember several more of the many remarkable lives lost to COVID-19 and much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
It has been 6 months since a massive fertilizer explosion at the port of Beirut tore through the city, leaving hundreds dead and catastrophic destruction. Lebanon was already mired in deep economic crisis. But now, after the blast, as special correspondent Leila Molana Allen tells us, add another crisis, COVID-19.
It's 9:35 p.m., and the Lebanese Red Cross's night team is racing to respond to yet another critical COVID-19 call. Lebanon has no official ambulance service, so these young volunteers are the front line of pandemic defense. This 85-year-old woman is fighting for every breath. There's nothing more they can do in the ambulance. She needs a hospital bed. But after a massive uptick in cases here in the past few weeks, those are hard to find.
The hospitals in Lebanon are suffering from a shortage in resources. And we've experienced multiple times and multiple missions when we transport a patient to the hospital that there's no room, either in the emergency room or in ICU or even in the whole hospital.
The intensive care unit at the hospital they've come to is full. She only makes it inside because her doctor reserved a space for her in advance, knowing she might deteriorate. 6 months ago, an enormous explosion swept through Beirut, tearing apart homes and lives. It killed more than 200 people, injured thousands more, and left large swathes of the city in tatters. My own neighborhood of Mar Mikhail was left in pieces. Many of its residents have come back and rebuilt. Some had nowhere else to go. But the area is a shell of its former self. This was once one of the busiest streets in Beirut, lined with crowded cafes, bars, restaurants, and shops. While some of them have been rebuilt, others are still piles of rubble. And thanks to the pandemic, it's still a ghost town.
The explosion was yet another blow in a year that had already seen the currency lose 80% of its value and food prices triple, while many lost their life savings. The government, having done little to tackle the country's economic freefall, swore it would rapidly punish those responsible for the blast. Instead, it has spent months gridlocked in political infighting. And now, just as the city was getting back on its feet, it's been floored by a devastating wave of COVID-19 and a nationwide lockdown imposed upon a population with nothing left to give. One of the country's largest hospitals, LAU Rizik, has only just recovered from the damage it sustained in the blast. Now they're building again, racing against time to add more capacity before they're hit by another spike. They've already repurposed two extra floors above the packed ICU as COVID wards. They were full almost as soon as they were complete. The ER is full too.
We treated a lot of patients on the chairs, under the tent, outside the ER. We put some extension for the oxygen to oxygenate the patient standing in the stretcher outside the ER. It was a very chaotic and very severe 2 weeks.
The rise in cases came after the government chose to prioritize the economy over health over the holiday season, lifting restrictions to allow tens of thousands to gather at bars, restaurants, and parties. The resulting virus spread carried a heavy toll. More people have now died of coronavirus in the last 4 weeks here than in all of 2020. The test positivity rate has been 20% or higher for weeks. The World Health Organization says movement restrictions should remain until it falls below 5% for at least 2 weeks. If they're lifted anytime soon, doctors fear another spike.
Are you worried the government, for political reasons, will lift the lockdown?
It's a struggle between economy and politics and science. In my opinion, this is the way how we should be living for the next at least year.
But even as doctors beg for an extension, there's already talk of easing the restrictions. Lebanese say they can't take much more of this lockdown, one of the harshest in the world. In place for nearly a month, it's imposed a 24/7 curfew, with all shops, including food stores, closed. Many here work daily cash-in-hand jobs, so if they're not working, they're not earning. 6 months ago, we met the Mitri family after their home was decimated by the explosion. Ever since, they've been rebuilding. It was nearly livable again, but then the curfew stopped construction workers finishing the job. Their father, Joseph, refused to leave the house even when it was at its worst, but the rest of the family are split across the city and beyond, staying with friends and relatives. desperate to bring them home after months apart. He's completing what he can himself. His son Mahad has moved back in to help, sleeping on the floor amidst the plaster dust.
No, but the paint is still wet on the floor. It's that freshly done.
The grocery store where Camille, the youngest, works is closed. It's still doing delivery and letting trusted customers pick up items, but he's not needed behind the counter. Only his sister and mother work in exempted jobs.
So you're not able to work?
No.
Your father isn't able to work?
No.
Your brother is trying?
Yeah, it's trying.
So the other three of you are surviving on your mother and sister's salary, basically?
Yeah, that's it. Because of them, we are living, like, a little bit.
Mahad still needs surgery to remove glass from the explosion that's embedded in his hand and arm. But he's been without wages for so long, he can't risk having his hands out of action if the lockdown lifts and he's able to work again.
Like, we're like 20 days at home, like no money, like nothing, you know. So it's hard.
How long will you continue like that, do you think?
I cannot. Like, we need to live, we need to get our jobs back, we need income in our hands, you know. Like, it's really hard, you know? It's really hard here.
The Mitris are lucky by Lebanese standards. They've used up most of their savings getting through the lockdown, but they still have a little money coming in. And a charity paid for most of their rebuilding work. Others here haven't been so fortunate. The mood on the streets now is hopeless. A recent call for protests in the capital, which just a year ago saw hundreds of thousands taking to these streets, calling for better governance, fell flat. Gone is the idealism that change will come. Life here has become simply a fight to survive. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Leila Milana Allen in Beirut.
And now to the analysis of Brooks and Capehart. That is New York Times columnist David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart, columnist for The Washington Post. Very good to see both of you this Friday night. Let's start by talking about the Republican Party. Jonathan, the Republicans in the House of Representatives this week voted, just in the last day, voted not to take away committee assignments from Marjorie Taylor Greene, conspiracy theorist, someone who's made deeply disturbing statements. They left it to the full House, meaning Democrats took that vote. She said, Greene said today, that it didn't really bother her, that committees don't matter, and besides, it's Donald Trump's party anyway. Is she right?
Well, she's right in that it's Donald Trump's party, but she's wrong about the fact that it doesn't matter. It does matter. And if she doesn't think committee assignments or being assigned to a committee matters, then she shouldn't be in government. She should resign her seat if she doesn't believe that sitting on a committee, doing the work of being an elected representative and representing your constituents in Congress, if that doesn't matter, then perhaps she should go back to Georgia. But this is indeed Donald Trump's party. And we saw it with the votes that were taken within the Republican caucus. Marjorie Taylor Greene was able to hold on to her committee seat because the vote was a public vote within the caucus. Liz Cheney was able to hold on to her leadership post within the Republican caucus because that vote was a secret ballot. And we talked all last week or all this week about how her hold on her leadership post was tenuous because the base was so angry, the caucus was so angry. And yet, by secret ballot, she won re-election to that leadership post within the caucus overwhelmingly. So this might be Donald Trump's Republican Party, but behind closed doors within the Republican caucus, at least as it's playing out in the House, there are some tensions there.
And David, I mean, what Congresswoman Greene actually said was that it's a waste of time. She views committees as a waste of time. But my question to you is, what does this say about the Republican Party in Congress?
Yeah, I've decided to look on the bright side. I think this was the week we saw more anti-Trump activity in the Republican Party than any week in the last 5 years. We've had Mitch McConnell calling Marjorie Taylor Greene's ideas cancerous. Liz Cheney won by 2-1. That was not automatic. And it shows there's a lot of people who in the House Republican caucus who are not with the Trumpsters. They're a little intimidated by them, But in private, that's not where their views are. We had Nebraska Senator Ben Sasse with a very forthright assault on the GOP of one of the counties in Nebraska who want to censure him. And so people are beginning to stand up in ways that haven't happened. And I think partly January 6th, partly looking at what the things the Green believes, they see, as McConnell said, that these are just disastrous cancers for the party. And so it's not all the way there, but we're beginning to see much more of an assault than we saw before. And then just finally, we had 10 Republican senators break from a bit of their party and put out a COVID relief proposal. So I'm seeing progress.
Well, let's pursue that. I mean, Jonathan, I interviewed former Missouri Senator John Danforth this week, who said his party, who he says he's still a Republican, has become, he said, a grotesque caricature of what it once was, that it's no longer conservative. It's a populist at the extremes. Where do you see this going, is the question.
Well, I do agree with David that there are green shoots, to use a phrase from a previous presidency, green shoots of progress, and you know, maybe even a green shoots of a new beginning. But the Republican Party right now is going through, I think, is going to be a multi-cycle refreshing. That these green shoots that we are seeing, will that mean that Republicans become more emboldened and stand up for themselves? And going into the midterm elections, the non-Trump Republicans get elected. Maybe even Republicans take over the House, but not with Trump Republicans. I don't know. But what I do know is this. The Republican Party is not going to cure itself of what former Senator Danforth talked about until it has concerted leadership within the caucus to push the Marjorie Taylor Greens and the other folks within that caucus, because she is not the only one, push them aside and get about the business of governing. You know, I focus on House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, who should have used the Marjorie Taylor Greene moment as a leadership moment to do what a leader is supposed to do and stand up for the values of the party and the caucus and to push aside those who run afoul of that. I don't know what Leader McCarthy stands for. I don't know what the Republican Party stands for. And if his calculations this week are about retaking the House in 2022, my question is, what is your program? What are you for? Because unless you can tell the American people, and particularly folks in the districts around the country, unless you can tell people what the Republican Party will do and what Leader McCarthy would do as Speaker proactively, positively, then why should the American people look at the Republican Party as a viable alternative to the Democratic Party?
Well, speaking of what the Republicans can do, David, you mentioned the Republican role, I think, in COVID relief. What role do you see them playing as the president is saying we need to go big, Republicans and even some Democrats raising questions?
Yeah, Joe Biden ran on bipartisanship and unity. He had a chance when the 10 Republicans put forth their $618 billion proposal to say, okay, let's try for a week. I'm not going to give you more than a week, but I'll give you a week. And we'll see if you can get you over a trillion. The Republicans have already voted for roughly $4 trillion in aid. I think they could have gotten a fifth. But the problem is, aside from Joe Biden, I don't think there's any taste for bipartisanship in the Democratic Party, sometimes with justified reason. They've just lived through the horror of the Trump presidency. They just lived through January 6th. They just don't have much respect or trust for the Republican Party, and so they don't want to do bipartisanship. I think those 10 Republicans really do. I think there are another 10 or 15 in the Senate who would prefer it. They're not going to go as big as Biden wants to go, but I think they would like it. But you can't tell people to trust people they don't trust. Trust takes time, and the trust is not there for bipartisanship in this Congress. I think Biden really wants to do it. The evidence of this week is we're just not going to see that.
Jonathan, what do you see as the outlook for bipartisanship?
Well, it depends on your definition of bipartisanship. If bipartisanship, you mean sitting with people from the other side of the aisle, talking through the issues, talking through policies and programs, and then as president of the United States, you decide that what you have heard does not meet the policy proposals that you have in mind and the mandate you feel you have from the American people, well, then if you go a different route, that doesn't mean that you haven't been bipartisan. It just means that you have a different governing philosophy. I do think President Biden has lived up to his promise to be bipartisanship. He didn't have to meet with those 10 senators, and yet he did. I do think that, David was absolutely right in what he said and in his terrific column today in the New York Times. I don't think that Democrats don't want to do bipartisanship. I do think that Democrats do suffer from a lack of trust because they have been Charlie Brown to the Republicans, Lucy, with the football. When President Obama was in the White House, President Obama tried desperately to negotiate in good faith with Republicans, only to have them say no, be recalcitrant. And having learned that lesson, President Biden, having been part of the Obama-Biden White House, does not want to be in that position, nor should he, especially when you have millions of Americans who are not only suffering through a pandemic, but also through the resultant economic crisis.
And David, lingering effects, I mean, if the Democrats end up doing this with Democratic votes, what's the fallout? What does that mean for the future?
Well, the people do really like bipartisanship. Our own Amy Walter had a good column this week saying that when you try to pass something with on a partisan basis, what happens is that piece of legislation tends to be unpopular because independents would rather you do it on a bipartisan basis. So I think in the long term, Democrats probably made it slightly more likely the Republicans will do very well in the midterm if they ram this through on a partisan basis. Having said that, you know, I think the size of our social problems are so large that $1.9 trillion basically given to the least fortunate among us is about the right size. I wish they had done a bipartisanship. I wish the Republicans had come up to like $1.2 trillion. But I'm thinking about the country. I'm thinking about a country that is suffering from inequality, from decay, from declining prospects, from a rural-urban income gap. And $1.9 trillion can go a long way to setting us on a different social path, a more equal social path. And so despite my reservations about the way they're doing it, I still think it needs to be done.
Just a little over a minute left. I want to get from both of you your expectations for next week's impeachment trial, the second one, Jonathan, for President Trump. What do you think will happen?
I think we will hear wrenching testimony in that the House impeachment managers will present a case that will bring the American people and the witnesses/jurors back to that day on January 6th. I expect the moment to be probably one of the most impactful emotional moments in recent American history. But I also expect this trial to be short. I wouldn't be surprised if we're talking about the end of this trial a week from today.
And David, what do you expect?
Yeah, that sounds about right. I'm mostly struck by how Donald Trump has sort of vanished. Obviously, he's off Twitter, but he's not really taking any measures to be anywhere. And so this is going to be a one-sided affair, which will end in an acquittal, and then we'll get back to business. I'll be very curious to see if the nation tunes in or whether they're really ready to move on from the Trump era.
Well, we are going to be covering it, and we are going to be asking the two of you about it 1 week from tonight at exactly this time. David Brooks, Jonathan Capehart, thank you both.
Thanks, Judy.
After a week reaching yet another tragic milestone in the COVID-19 death toll, we remember five remarkable individuals here in the U.S. who've lost their lives to the pandemic.
No, I never saw them at all. All there was you.
Freddy Perez de Tagle loved to sing, whether it was in his church choir or just answering the phone, his son told us. He moved from the Philippines to Toledo, Ohio in his 20s to be with his wife, Priscilla. A dedicated grandfather, Freddy loved the outdoors and camping. He also had a lifelong interest in fashion. His family said he took pride in choosing what to wear every day. Freddie was 67 years old. Service was at the center of Carolyn Barnes' life. She was an enthusiastic volunteer at her church in Pensacola, Florida, and worked as a caregiver in assisted living and daycare centers. She was matter-of-fact and outspoken, her son said, and always told her large family about the importance of helping others. She was 77 years old. Steve Prince came from a family of journalists, following in the footsteps of his father and grandmother. Steve loved copy editing at the South Bend Tribune, where he worked for 33 years and met his wife, Mary. Introspective and humble, his wife told us he was passionate about the positive effect newspapers could have in their communities. Steve was an avid runner and quietly donated his money and time to several causes, including as a dedicated volunteer at his local hospital, his wife said. Steve was 75 years old. Juan Ordonez was always smiling and making jokes, his family told us, adding that he was warm and adventurous and quick to make friends. A native of Peru, he moved to New Jersey when he was just 13 years old and took pride in mastering English. Juan was hardworking, fascinated by computers, and gained a degree in IT while working full-time. His wife said he was a romantic and a hands-on dad to their 5-year-old Mia. Juan loved traveling, watching comedy shows, and the Peruvian national soccer team. He was 40 years old. 91-year-old Reverend Doja Carlson was seen as the matriarch of the Phoenix retirement community, where she worked and lived for decades. Doja always fought for the underdog, her brother told us. She was an advocate for the elderly and 40 years ago started a nonprofit for older adults. The organization still serves hundreds of people in Phoenix every day. She overcame the effects of a childhood bout with polio and later a cancer diagnosis. A friend said Doja was a compassionate minister and a talented musician.
We thank all of you family members who shared these stories with us. Our hearts go out to you as they do to everyone who's lost a loved one in this pandemic. Prior to the pandemic, Broadway was booming, breaking box office records in 11 of the last 12 years. But curtains haven't risen since March, with deep personal and financial impacts. By one count, Broadway is directly responsible for nearly 100,000 jobs in New York City alone. And as a leading attraction for people who travel to the city, it has an economic impact of nearly $15 billion. Jeffrey Brown is back with that report for our arts and culture series, Canvas.
Rousing music and thrilling energy.
I'm past patiently waiting, I'm passionately smashing.
Soaring language and high drama.
Let's begin by restoring this man to his family.
Broadway is all that, but now it's closed, and the pandemic has exposed how much more there is to it.
I don't think most people think of actors, for example, as the middle class workers that the majority of us are. They also don't really think about the arts and entertainment industry's impact on the economy.
Kate Schindel is an actor whose credits include the national tour of Fun Home. Now she's an out-of-work actor who also happens to be president of the Actors Equity Union, a non-paying job, by the way, dealing closely with an industry in crisis.
Look, making a living in our industry, being a professional actor or stage manager, is one of the hardest things you can do, even on a good day. It's an incredibly unstable and unpredictable way to make a living. But when it stretches on past a year, which it's about to, I think that there's a very real possibility that a lot of people will leave the business because they're not exactly sure what they're waiting for.
I'm a song and dance man. I've worked all over the country, a few national tours. I've gotten to work here in New York at Lincoln Center. The career was great until it wasn't anymore.
For years, 37-year-old Rashawn James II did what actors and dancers have always done. Work when they get gigs, supplement their income as waiters, bartenders, and doing other odd jobs.
I was an alcohol slinger. I would stand inside of liquor stores and give tastings, and I got a percentage of the bottles that I would sell.
With that work also gone, James turned to even odder temporary jobs, working for the census, then as a poll worker, and now, to his immense surprise, as deputy campaign manager for a friend running for city council in Manhattan.
Who I am is being redefined every day, because now someone asks me, well, what do you do? It's like, oh, I work in politics. So in that way, I'm redefining myself and trying to find avenues to make sure that every time I feel like I'm getting into some sort of slump, I find a way out of it.
While most of us focus on what happens on stage, commercial theater is an enormous ecosystem.
Oh, nice. I didn't realize they've done these yet.
Playing out largely behind the scenes in places like this.
Awesome. We're the department that's really good at putting our heads down and getting the job done. We don't really make a fuss. We don't want to be noticed. We want to make sure that we facilitate the relationship between the designer and the performer.
John Christensen's 20-year-old company makes the costumes for Broadway shows and performances of all kinds. It's highly specialized, made-to-order work, performed by skilled artisans. Christensen laid off all of his 52 workers, and with little work, has less than a third on hand now.
When it started to become terrifying was when things were happening like Disney closing Frozen on Broadway because it was too hard to open it up again. And we started to see this shift in trying to get people to talk to us, figure out what to do for our people, who are my family.
Now Christensen has joined more than 50 other shops to form the Costume Industry Coalition, fighting for their very survival.
These costume shops are all small businesses.
The group released videos with celebrity testimonials and demonstrations of all that goes into the making of a costume.
The people that are doing their beading, sewing the garments and putting the thread in. It's a lot of people that are doing this, each one very important. We need to make sure that they make it through this.
It's one of many relief efforts. Since last March, the Actors Fund has given $18 million in emergency financial assistance to more than 15,000 people.
My insurance is running out at the end of March.
And hold Zoom seminars like this for those whose insurance has run out. In December, Tina Fey hosted an NBC special, One Night Only, The Best of Broadway, that raised more than $3 million. And the coronavirus relief package passed by Congress in December included $15 billion for Save Our Stages, aid for venues from small clubs to Broadway theaters.
In New York City.
Others help in their own ways. When the long-running TV show Law & Order SVU resumed production in September, executive producer Warren Light announced he would hire as many unemployed theater actors as possible, more than 30 so far.
We were aware that people were losing health insurance in Broadway. People it's been a tough time. We just thought, let's not fly people in from other cities. Let's not look so much to the TV acting pool. Let's try and keep the local Broadway pool that we've always relied on. Let's help as much as we can.
Plus, Light says his show benefits from the talents of suddenly available top Broadway stars.
The objection is sustained.
Several, including Tony Award winner Adrian Lenox, have played judges.
Judges need a certain kind of authority, and if you can hit the back wall of the Winter Garden, you can handle arraignment court here.
Of course, there are only so many judges, even on the Law & Order franchise. The real questions, when will Broadway return, and what will it look like?
We have had no revenue for 9 months now. We most likely won't have it for another 8 months. We are the first industry that went out, and will most likely be the last one in.
Charlotte St. Martin, president of the Broadway League, the trade group for commercial theater in the U.S., says Broadway faces unusually daunting challenges.
Broadway is a very, very expensive business. We looked at socially distancing because the state was asking us to try. And the most seats that we could fill in the biggest theater was 27%. We need 75% for most shows to even break even.
For now, St. Martin and others say the focus must be on sustaining the people and the work they do that make up this great American industry. So there will be an industry to return to. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown.
In recognition of Black History Month, tonight's Brief But Spectacular comes from historian Dinah Ramey Berry, who chairs the History Department at the University of Texas at Austin. She is dedicated to rethinking the way we teach American history to students of all ages. Her latest book is called A Black Women's History of the United States.
I have a son who's now in his teen years. His first racial experience was at age 3. We had just moved to Austin, Texas, and we were in a neighborhood meeting about the community we were in. We were the only Black family that were there. And my son comes downstairs at 3 years old when he was pouting. I said, "What's wrong, honey?" He said, "They told me I had to be the bad guy because I'm Black." And he said, "And I want to be the good guy. I want to be the hero, and I want to be the one that saves people." The mothers were frozen. They didn't even know what to say. It was totally uncomfortable for me after that. I didn't want to leave the meeting because I wanted my son to know that we're going to stand there, we're going to still be there, and that he can be who he wants to be. And so that night when we tucked him in, my husband and I talked to him about who he comes from and the people, just like my parents told me so much about African-American history and culture as a child, because outside of our house setting, our home setting, we are criminalized. When I was growing up, African-American history was literally one paragraph. There were Africans came and they were enslaved. There was Harriet Tubman, Frederick Douglass, and then a jump to Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King. We learned about 4 people in African-American history. Now where I sit, and I know that 4 million people received their freedom, or took their freedom, or were granted their freedom, stole their freedom in 1865 and even before that moment. There are so many stories that we can understand about survival, about resilience, about pride, and about the African-American experience in the United States that goes beyond those 4 great figures. Teaching Texas Slavery is a digital humanities project that I've been working on with a team of scholars for a number of years. And this project is a way to teach young children about the contributions of African-Americans, to look at them in their eyes, to understand the humanity of the enslaved and their contributions to the state of Texas. In my work, I try to honor the voices and the experience of people who were enslaved, because for so long in the historical literature, nobody asked them about how they experienced slavery. They talked about enslaved people by making them objects, but these were human beings. And for me, I think it's important to try to read and think about moments, historical moments, from their perspectives. Kids can absolutely handle hard truths. Some of the best conversations that I've had about history and about the history of slavery have been with 5-year-olds, 7-year-olds, 9-year-olds. It is so important that we know our history, that we teach all aspects of history, even the tough parts, the subjects that make us uncomfortable, the subjects that make us feel ashamed about our nation. That's when we are in a place where we can move forward and grow and live in a realistic space, and students don't feel betrayed by high school education, by junior high school education, and by elementary school education. My name is Dinah Ramey Berry, and this is my brief but spectacular take on understanding the past to live a better future.
And you can find all of our brief but spectacular segments online at pbs.org/newshour/brief. A reminder to tune in later tonight on PBS when our own Lisa Desjardins guest hosting on Washington Week. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening, or sorry, Monday evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you and have a good, safe weekend.